To you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. And you make it all possible. Free Culture Radio is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is composed and performed by Tom Nickel in Four Dimensional Nightmare and is used with permission of the artist. Free Culture Radio is available as a podcast or direct download. Find links at the website kboo.fm/freeculture. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Soul Queens and Blues Kings, making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Norman Boogie Cat, Sylvester, and band bring together regional rhythm and blues acts for a night of music and dance as a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon. Again, that's Soul Queens and Blues Kings making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
You ready?
I'm ready, man.
Only way out is through.
Black men, they don't get the benefit of the doubt. They don't even get the benefit of the next breath.
Man, it's hard being black. It's not easy,
especially being black as a African-American male. It's almost kind of like you're like an endangered species in a way.
There's a stigma, there's an expectation, there's a profile, there is a box.
It's always been kind of like that black man that had to rise up.
And I was just like, you know, I'm gonna be honest with you, man. I'm nervous about this trip.
We'll probably be the only five brothers.
I can go out west. I can prepare. I know what it's like. This is almost like an untouched area. So I don't know what it's going to be like out here.
Me as a veteran, that's just one layer. There's also many layers of me as a black man and the road that I have walked.
The outdoors gave me a rebirth.
This is recent. This right. Is like real stuff is happening. This is like this, but if they've been in the fight for so many years, they still have not won.
It's going to take an act of Congress to change it.
I always wanted to feel like I was a part of it. I was in community.
Historically, we've been outside for years, so. Do you, if you haven't experienced some of these things, how would you know, right?
I do think it's important we show them a positive image of black maleness, but I also think it's more important that we show them the holisticness of what black maleness can be.
As we're projecting that forward into the present, you know, I think that we've got an opportunity to redefine, you know, what those historical roles and identities were.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. wherever you're at on earth, listening to Culture in Motion, whether you're on KBOO.FM or here in Portland or in the Northwest, listening to 90.7 or wherever you might find this show on the dial. Welcome, Culture in Motion. Culture in Motion is where we talk about culture, politics, art, activism, music, and the intersection of these things. We just watched the trailer for Black Waters. We have the creator, the director, producer, Chad Brown on. Chad, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, man. Good to have me here. I'm looking forward to taking a little dive with you, man. Really appreciate it.
Right on. That was an amazing trailer. I get really excited when I watch that. I've known you for a number of years. I think what stands out to me is it's not just you and your story, but you've incorporated the story of four other Black men. You want to say a little bit about this project and just let the people know what you would like people to think about in terms of Black Waters?
Yeah, it's an interesting story that's unfolding here with Black Waters. I think it's interesting. It's very complex. We have, four Black men and then me, number five. We come with different backgrounds, different walks in life, and different challenges of experiences that we have faced as Black men in our path and our journey in life, and we all come together in the Arctic, creating one story, which five stories that turns into one story. This journey of us, exploring many different issues and challenges that Black men face, including our own challenges that we have faced as well. And so it's pretty an insight of our lives. But I think, to be fair, I think by having five of us out there, it also easily represents many other Black men, because we have different stories and different dynamics happening. And it gives people who are not of BIPOC, Black Indigenous people of color, space, of more of white folks, just an opportunity, and it is an opportunity to sit and listen and learn from what Black men go through or deal with and challenges. It's a learning opportunity, and it's a journey for all of us, basically, and so we have a lot to share, and it was an honor to be amongst the other brothers who are willing to play a role in this documentary piece, and to be vulnerable and to be open with their experience. And so it's a very interesting take, and also sensitive and with a lot of depth.
It's funny because in the age of social media, and a lot of saturation from the entertainment industry, there are very narrow images of how Black men get represented. And what interests me, even though that trailer is only 2 minutes and 40 seconds, I'm seeing a lot of depth and complexity that we don't get to see when we see how Black men are depicted in entertainment and in the media. How did you pick your cast, the four other brothers besides yourself? How did you decide who you wanted to work with and tell the story of those brothers?
Yeah, these brothers, some I have really long relationships with and some I don't. It was an immediate relationship. And I think, how I picked them was, they're owners and mavericks in their own space of what they are doing to make change in the world. And that was very, very important to me because I wanted to connect and have brothers that are doing it, making change, and they are rising to the top in their own way. And I thought, it'll be really cool to have these brothers come together with these very eclectic backgrounds and the professionalism of what they have done, experience, et cetera, and bring their experiences, et cetera, to the table. That was very important to me because it goes back to what you see from Hollywood, TV, even print material. Black men are not represented in the right light. You know, the stereotypes out there, you know, just down to the fundamental basics of I can walk into an elevator, which all black men can experience, and you find some white person or whatever that will kind of move to the right a little bit and hold their purse or something, you know. And a lot of that is off of our subconscious of what we have been subjected to and been seen from TV, Hollywood, that tends to fall into a default of streets. And how we run the streets, and so I wanted to make sure to show a different side of black men, and there's many black men out there that are just really doing amazing work and really engaging with the community, you know, even in the professional corporate world, etc. And so I wanted to make sure to have this side of black men in the light on the film, basically, and where people can be able to see, you know, what we are doing and what we are about, and show strong representation. But most important, it also is a domino effect that I believe where young black boys can be inspired by, and when they see five black men that are not into sports, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know, et cetera. But we are amongst many in the community doing some really amazing celebrity work in our own right, and it's all positive, and it's all you know, powerful, and it's life changing. And so I really wanted to, you know, find those kind of black men that are doing it. And that's kind of like how I selected and connected. And we were all friends. We're all in the water, you know, and fishing. And it just kind of happened by default of us coming together naturally to do something like this, basically.
So, you know, for the people that didn't actually see it because we're on radio and they're going to be listening, you mentioned we're on the water and we're fishing. So
yeah.
I know, you know, for as long as I've known you, fly fishing, getting into the wildlands, specifically your relationship with the Arctic, is very central to the work that you do and right. Who you are. So will you expand that for the listeners? Talk about what fishing means, what it means to be black and outdoors, and your relationship to the Arctic.
Yeah. You know, fishing, fly fishing has saved my life, and it's a big part of my life. Really big into the angling and the spiritual part of the angling as well. And through my work as an angler, that has led me to launch two organizations, actually, that's pretty much based off of angling as a fly fisherman, and which is Soul River and Love is King. From those two organizations, I do, you know, expeditions up into the Arctic Circle. And up in the Arctic Circle, we bring youth and veterans in that space. We bring BIPOC leaders into that space. We engage with indigenous communities. And also, if we tie that back into the adventure part of connecting to the water, connecting to the land, the wildlife. And at the end of the day, bringing smiles on your face, chasing fish, you know. And so yeah. That's the that's the, you know, the fundamental part of it, you know, is chasing fish. And so everybody gets an opportunity to learn how to fly fish, learn how to catch fish, you know, and explore and build, you know, the experience. And that experience turns into an advocacy of supporting and protecting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and also taking a stand on the behalf of supporting the Gwich'in community, indigenous community up there in the north. And so, you know, so that's kind of like my ties. And so the fishing part that ties in with the team here with Black Waters, you know, we all came together on a river. It was at a convention down in North Carolina. and we broke away. We're on the river fishing together. And just by fundamentally basics, if this fell in default, that we just all found ourselves connected by the water. We was all of us standing waist deep in the water, five brothers, which was very odd, something that you don't see every day. And we just had the synergy that happened amongst us, the how nature brought us all together. And just by default, we clicked. It became an immediate brotherhood. And from that brotherhood, it also rolled itself into the concept of Black Waters and doing a film. It was actually started out as just a trip of brothers. You know, that's kind of like what we're about to do. Just it was going to be just a trip for the brothers to basically go back out on the water and fish together. And then a little bit later, you know, I kind of pitched this idea to the team, and you know, the team was like, yeah, let's do it. You know, and so that pitch was actually turning this trip into a film and story. And so that's kind of like how that evolved, basically. But yeah,
so this film is going to premiere in Portland at the Billy Frank Jr. Conference Center at the EcoTrust building. That's 721 Northwest 9th Avenue on the second floor in Portland, Oregon. What's the date of that premiere, though?
The date is May 27th. It's going to be from 1 to 5 p.m.
Okay, so you're going to show it a couple times or just once? How long is the film?
We're shooting the show twice, actually.
Okay.
And it's going to be also followed with a panel. The team of Black Waters, they'll be flying in to be part of that panel all together, all of us together. And so after the film, we'll have like a panel, a Q&A with the audience, basically, for deeper conversation, living room conversation style, basically. But yeah, and people get an opportunity to meet the team of Black Waters as well.
Are you guys going to get on the water together while they're out here in this part of the country?
That would be nice, but under the time frame, they will be flying in and flying back home the next day. You know.
So again, that's May 27th from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Billy Frank Conference Center at the EcoTrust Building, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue on the second floor. I'm going to ask you the hard questions as our last questions. I just know the audience that listens to KBOO, and there's going to be people in this audience who go, well, Black men, what about Black women? What about Black trans people? What about non-binary and identifying Black people? And ask that question about representation.
Right.
Before you answer, I also want to say that I've been in spaces with you where you are creating space for other Black identified people to have representation and have platform and speak for themselves. But how would you answer that question?
Well, you know what? That's pretty complex, and you know, I really strive to make everybody happy, but I just can't, you know, and so, but the best way I can answer that is from observing what's happening in the outdoor industry, specifically, you know, and there's many other industries, but coming out of outdoor industry as a fly fisherman, as a nonprofit owner, founder that does work in the outdoor industry, and me as an athlete, you know, there are many initiatives that are catering for LGBTQ communities and women communities as well. You know, and when you look, if you take a step back, there are little to zero, almost probably one or two of initiatives that's specifically around Black boys, Black men, in the outdoor industry. When you look at the magazines of Men's Health, you know, or Outside Magazine, you do not find Black male faces in a leadership type of role place. You find more of ethnic in those spaces of women and LGBTQ, but you don't see Black men. And so, you know, I thought about this for a bit, and I, you know, as I was writing this piece, you know, for the documentary, and wanted to show and why I did this, because I wanted to find space also for Black men, because there are Black men that are in the outdoors that are doing phenomenal work, talented. They are masters at their craft. And, you know, from survivalists to climbers to kayakers, you know, and we don't, we do not get that opportunity to have a platform or have space in the outdoor world. And it's hard. And so, you know, creating space for this particular initiative to show the importance of Black men, especially how this is connected to young Black boys, is very, very important. And it's also one initiative that should be nurtured and respected and supported just as much as the LGBTQ and women initiatives as well. And, you know, they're all on the same, neither one is higher than the other. You know, but when we're talking about representation, we should be talking about representation for all and making space for all, you know, and so, and I think, you know, probably the lack of Black men in the outdoor space, in which there are Black men in the outdoor space, I think it's just has not really been any opportunity for Black male leadership to step into the space and to show the success and the professionalism of who we are and what we are capable and able to do, you know. And so that's probably the best way I can tackle on that. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty complex, you know. And you know, and I feel like every gender, every race, culture needs to be elevated and represented in their own right. I just feel like, you know, when I'm looking at the outdoor industry world, you do not see the leadership of Black male in the spaces that are in that light to be able to show change, and also for young Black boys to make that connection and to be inspired by, and to know that there is an awesome African-American angler, or awesome African-American kayaker, or awesome African-American nonprofit leader that is making massive waves in the outdoor industry by, you know, nurturing young Black boys and exposing young Black boys into the outdoors in this own space. And so I think that's the best way I can answer that. But yeah.
Right on. I appreciate the work you're doing, Chad. Like some of my people have said, you know, nothing about us without us. And I interpret that to mean like it's going to take all of us, you know. And so to the degree that we can help create spaces for other marginalized people on the come up to have a platform, we also cannot speak for people. We have right. to respect people speaking for themselves. And so, you know, we have to do work to speak for ourselves as we honor other people, exactly. right, to speak up. Thank you for coming on and sharing Black Waters. I can't wait for the public to see it. I can't wait to see the whole movie again. You said May 27th?
Yeah, May 27th, yes.
At the Billy Frank Conference Center at the Eco Trust, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue, from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. All right, Chad. Have a good day, brother.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. Thank you.
Okay.
No, nobody has any weapons.
Good evening, everybody. This is Mike Crenshaw. You were just listening to Chad Brown from Soul River. Soul River Runs Deep and Love is King, talking about the Black Waters film. There's actually been a change of dates. The film was going to premiere May 27th at the Billy Frank Jr. Conference Center at the Eco Trust Building. That's downtown on, let me pull up the address right here, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue. But that date has been moved forward by a few months. It's going to be premiering August 26, 1 to 5 p.m. at the Billy Frank Jr. Conference Center downtown at the Eco Trust Building. Northwest Portland, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue. We're going to transition into the next part of our program tonight. I want to say a few things. We're going to be dealing with some subjects that we often touch here on Culture and Motion that are deep, that are intense, that are part of the reality that we've lived and survived historically and are going through currently. I'm talking about anti-fascism. I'm talking about the movement for Black lives. Anti-fascism as a movement, as a consciousness, is what the word Antifa is an abbreviation for. The KBOO sponsored podcast called It Did Happen Here, which detailed the recent history of anti-fascist and anti-racist organizing in the Pacific Northwest, in Portland, as well as Minneapolis, and had some intersections with Chicago and other Midwestern cities as well. That podcast, if you listen to it, It Did Happen Here, has been turned into a book. We aired it on KBOO. KBOO helped us produce it. PM Press has published a book. So follow PM Press on Instagram. Follow It Did Happen Here on Instagram. You can go to itdidhappenherepodcast.com and find out more about the episodes and the podcast itself. The book is available online for pre-orders through pmpress.org Friday, April 28th. That's a week from this Friday at 8 p.m. Anti-fascist music and the It Did Happen Here book release party. The official book release party is going to be held at Dante's. It's going to feature punk rock as well as hip hop. The Mistons, featuring Sean Krogan, Love and Hell, Swiggle Mandela, and Last of a Dying Breed, featuring Michael Fletcher and myself, Mike Crenshaw, is going to be 8 p.m. Friday, April 28th at Dante's. That's 350 West Burnside in downtown Portland. It's going to be $12 in advance, $15 at the door. So support the release of the It Did Happen Here book as well as the It Did Happen Here podcast. Next up, I want to give my listeners a warning. The next interview portrays graphic descriptions and depictions. There's going to be some footage that's actual footage that's going to be premiered here on KBOO right now. And the footage is exclusive. It's of a mass shooting that happened, a violent incident. Multiple people were targeted by a mass shooter. And one woman, June Knightley, a.k.a. T-Rex, died at the scene. So I want to give you a warning. In the interview, I state that all my guests were present for the shooting, but Catherine Knapp was not. She's the wife of June T-Rex Knightley, who was killed by the first shot fired. Ben Smith, the shooter, has received a life sentence. He'll be eligible to apply for parole in 55 years. Thank you for tuning in to Culture in Motion.
Always to make that connection and to be inspired by and to know that there is an awesome African-American
kayaker. So we'll get to our cue point and play that footage in a second here. If you've been paying attention to the story, you know, I'm hoping that there's some closure in the sentencing. It's a complex issue. But let's listen to the interview and the footage.
All right, Chad. Have a good day, brother.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. Thank you.
Okay.
No, nobody has any weapons. He came up to us and started a fight, and June got out of her car. She's 50. She shot her. Ma'am, real quick, just... We're traffic partners. Why are you shooting at us? All we do is keep people safe. All we do is protect people. Why would you shoot her?
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you're at on earth. You're tuned into Culture in Motion on KBOO.FM or KBOO 90.7 FM, community radio here in Portland, Oregon. With me today, I have a number of special guests. We're here to talk about a tragic event that happened on February 19th, 2022. A mass shooter named Benjamin Smith opened fire on a group of unarmed women alone at the corner of Normandale Park. He killed one and injured three others, along with a medic who responded to a call for help. It was one of three shootings in Portland that day. The women were associated with the Black Lives Matter protests. They were there to provide traffic safety for the marchers. The marchers were assembled more than two full blocks away, completely out of sight, on the other side of a fenced baseball stadium, a dense line of trees, and a grassy field. The Portland Police Bureau's initial report, picked up in local and national media, was composed almost entirely of false claims. Their mischaracterization conjured an image of a boisterous crowd of protesters, some armed, and falsely depicted a homeowner defending his property from being violated. In fact, he hunted the most vulnerable people that he could find associated with the protests and attacked them with no provocation. Smith has pled guilty to 9 charges of murder, attempted murder, and assault. He is to be sentenced. This episode was recorded prior to sentencing. With me are 4 surviving women who endured Smith's assault and the wife of the 5th, June Knightley, a 60-year-old disabled woman who took Smith's first shot and died at the scene. I'd like to welcome my guests. And first of all, thank you for being here. And is there anything that any of you would like to add to the description?
No, you nailed it.
Okay. I think when I think about what happened that night, one of the first things that comes to mind, having not been there and having understood that somebody lost their life, I wondered whose side the people who were attacked were on. And when I listened to the reports, one of the first things that was brought up in the media was the fact that the shooter was a homeowner. They didn't name the shooter, but they identified them as a homeowner. And in doing so, in the imagination of those of us listening to the media reports, I think that the suggestion was that the protesters were somehow threatening somebody's private property, and therefore their lives mattered less than whoever this homeowner was. I found that to be disturbing in the context of other protesters and other people who stood with the movement for Black Lives who had been murdered. Sean Kilier, Mike Reno. I thought about Jeremy Christian and how it was civilians and not police that provided the initial medical care and the initial pursuit. I thought about the long history of support for racial terror by law enforcement in the state, in this country. Do any of you want to reflect on that in relation to your own experience with how this was reported and what actually happened?
I mean, I guess I can say, as the person who had the GoPro strapped to my face that recorded the whole thing, it was immediately, I mean, we were all immediately, obviously, deeply hurt and outraged by that mischaracterization, you know, of our friend and us as essentially armed home invaders. And I think it was very painful for me to see that because I knew what was on my camera and I knew that I had given them that camera. And as I had been doxxed and was put on the spot to defend us publicly, I spent so much time trying to defend all of us against that lie. It's time that I'll never get back, that none of us will ever get back, that we could have spent even attempting to heal from this. It's unforgivable.
I
think it also kind of creates this image in people's mind of, here comes, you know, violent Antifa to take over like a homeowner's space, that we're invading his personal space, where, you know, like when you say someone is a homeowner, it creates that image in their mind of like, oh, he's in his home defending his home, which is not true at all. We were on a public street. We were nowhere near anyone's home. You know, we weren't on anyone's private property, and he came out to us. We didn't go to him. He came out to us to attack us. And that characterization of him as a homeowner, I think, just really kind of leads people to think a certain way about what happened, and it's completely false.
Something that immediately, you know, on top of the obvious things, was, I mean, I guess beyond being just hurt and upset and feeling attacked, there's this worry that we always have, that we've had since the beginning. We, on the perimeter of marches, we interact with a lot of would-be vigilantes who believe that it's their duty to, you know, protect the city from this imaginary Antifa monster, and they realize that they can't reach their target without getting through traffic corpers. So they end up interacting with them. And every time this narrative gets pushed that protests are dangerous, protesters get targeted, which means traffic corpers get targeted. And as soon as I saw that lie, it reminded me of Ted Wheeler's comment about, you know, taking the city back and making them hurt a little bit. Who's going to face the consequences for that? When you're inspiring vigilantism, who gets hurt first?
Yeah.
To me, it kind of illustrated that the police were on the shooter's side as opposed to the victims and survivors' side. I was in the hospital when I found out that Ben Smith had been indicted, and my first response was to sob because I imagined in my mind that the police were going to take care of him in jail. Why wouldn't they, if they agreed with what he was doing?
Yeah. I, you know, coming up with my own history as a Black, you know, person surviving white supremacy in America, I observed firsthand the police protecting racial terrorists time and time again, when they would march, when they would have public demonstrations, and in the wake of violence where people were hurt or lost their lives. Often people would not face prosecution. I also noticed that continuing into, you know, beyond this, before this incident at Normandale Park, and since then, I've noticed that there seemed to be a national climate that was promoted in the media of vigilantism, and that people were encouraged to use their vehicles as weapons against corkers, against demonstrators. And this this vigilantism that ended in lost life and injury and serious bodily harm here in Portland seems to be part of that trend. When you think about what needs to happen, we can't take back what happened that night, you know, but going forward, what are some of the things that come to mind when you think about the culture of mass protests and demonstrations, as well as the minds of people and the imaginations of people who don't participate in this movement?
I think a lot of us got used to seeing negative media coverage. I know even like my own family, got to a point where they finally, after talking to me more frequently, just told me that they weren't even listening to the media anymore about what was happening at these demonstrations because they were so dishonest and selectively edited, almost in a propagandist sort of way. I think what's been like front of mind for most of us, at least on the perimeter, has just been that risk of vigilantism. And every time this narrative is pushed that protesters are violent, that demonstrations are dangerous, that the communities are in some sort of danger, it puts everyone at risk. And it never stopped. It never stopped. It only escalated. And then Kyle Rittenhouse comes along and gets away with murdering two
people. Right. Say that.
That's front of mind in this situation. I mean, in all of these situations and every interaction that we would have with aggressive people that were trying to get to a demonstration, it was this just constant reminder, at least for me, Kyle Rittenhouse got away with this.
And we just saw we saw something, you know, really similar in the news just 2 days ago with the person who murdered Garrett Foster, you know, that he's gonna be pardoned by the governor. And you know, I don't know. It was from the like Trump era, you know, it was from Trump's lips to national law enforcement, you know, investigating Antifa, you know, as a terrorist organization, to our local law enforcement, to our progressive mayor who just reiterated the same things, you know, that we're violent terrorists and that, you know, people should make us hurt a little bit. And it just activated, you know, every basement dweller who blames other people for their problems.
Yeah. It's a dangerous environment we're in. To our listeners, if you're listening, you know, tune into the conversation. You've been listening to Kat, Deja, Ali, Deg, and Hank, all who were there on February 19th, 2022 at Normandale Park. Looking at the work that you all were doing as Corkers, you're actually there to keep people safe. You're there to provide a protective barrier, to engage the sometimes hostile public, to inform people in the community of what's happening. What did official responders, the first responders, do or not do that you noticed? And why do you think they responded the way that they did?
Do you mean our first responders?
No, I mean the official responders. People tend to think of people in vehicles with sirens, with uniforms on.
So the first thing they did was they pointed guns at us. They prevented the paramedics from entering the scene, and they detained our medics who had been assisting and keeping the rest of us alive. I think the thing that probably stopped them from their just like frozen state was Deja just, you know, coming at them screaming like, what the f- are you doing?
Will you help us?
Yeah.
Will you please help us?
Like, why? Like, the police, all they were concerned about was how many people were in the crowd. That was something they kept asking me over and over again. And I was like, we never saw the crowd. I never saw the crowd. They were not with us ever. And they were concerned about these other things, not like, hey, there's a person on the ground who just murdered my friend, who like just tried to kill me. And their concern is not with what happened with the shooting, it's what happened with the crowd. Like, it just blew my mind that people were like that. And like, you know, to the credit of some of the first responders, the paramedics were great, and they're, you know, they came and helped us, and they tolerated me running around screaming at people, and were just kind of trying to corral me to get me into an ambulance. And I was like, I'm not leaving until my friends are in the ambulance. Like, I'm fine. And like, you know, I definitely was not fine. I got shot 4 times. I lost 2 pints of blood, and I was still just running on pure adrenaline. And the cops didn't give a shit. They tried to stop our medic from wrapping my head, because I got a wound in the back of my neck, and they weren't letting them like treat me. It's just
they interfered and delayed And I mean, at the point at which I ran at them, the medic that they ended up detaining and harassing, one cop had kind of started approaching. They were withholding ambulances. And this is almost 14 minutes into just the aftermath of the shooting. And I remember, and it's on my helmet camera video, this medic who saved Deg's life is yelling at this cop, five people are shot. And the cop is going, there's five people. And that's when I ended up running at them. And I didn't know that they had all of our other friends at gunpoint, but I could see the ambulances. And when they came on the scene, they came to secure the scene. And this is after Hank had told them one of the first things, to my knowledge, that the shooter had been subdued. The only reason we were alive was that the shooter had been subdued. He had two more high capacity magazines. He was still shooting when he got taken down. And the cops wasted so much time, and they wasted so much precious time allowing EMS onto the scene. They got onto the scene at about 13, 14 minutes after the shooting, and it was another 3 or 4 minutes before they let paramedics on scene. They went straight to the shooter. They argued with the medic that was trying to help him. They wasted so much time securing a man who was already on the ground shot while my friends bled out.
And mind you, every single one of us has received de-escalator training. Every single one of us, that's part of our role, is to be de-escalators. And many of us have also received training on how to secure a weapon. And we all know how to do that. And, you know, it's like the police just came and acted like there were still shots being fired when, you know, he'd been down for, you know, 15 minutes. So
we were threats even though we were down.
Yeah.
Right.
And they wanted it to seem like they were so concerned about securing the scene. But there's a video that's posted to Twitter of when the cops first come on scene. And they don't look very concerned about security. They're kind of just mulling around. You can see three of them harassing Allie in the background. There's about four of them standing over the shooter with our medic, and you like the video opens and you hear the police saying to our medic, get off him, get off him, get off him. And our medic is holding pressure on the shooter's gunshot wound, and the cops go, this is the police, like, I'm ordering you to get off of him. And he's like, I am holding pressure on a gunshot wound, and I will release pressure when one of you is ready to take over for me. Like, just the harassment. And then it pans the scene and there are just other police officers just sort of meandering with their rifles out, just sort of looking around. They are not, you know, casing the perimeter. They are not looking for threats. They are not looking for weapons. They are not securing the scene. Like, they are harassing people and just kind of standing around and talking.
So what you're describing is a scene where there's already been a deadly tragedy and potentially more life lost, and the police show up and contribute to the danger of the scene.
Absolutely.
Are completely apathetic in the best case scenario, and in the worst case, intentionally increasing the harm that's already been caused.
Absolutely.
And I know for myself, I was afraid that when the police showed up that they were going to shoot us.
Right.
You know, we know that we have to call them, because what else can you do? There's no Antifa homicide squad. You know what I mean? Like,
we don't have an ambulance.
We don't have an ambulance. We need them to come. And like, there was absolutely this fear that they were going to shoot us when they got on the scene.
I think one of the more dangerous things that has been happening, and this goes back to an earlier point, in the imaginations of a lot of the people who are not there and experiencing these things firsthand, is that Antifa has been described as this entity that somehow deserves the harm that people are directing at protesters. People will say things like, well, if you guys weren't damaging property, again, where we're putting property before human life, right? Then people wouldn't be so angry and treat you in the way that they do. I can only imagine processing the amount of trauma that, not only from the event, but going forward. How have you felt supported since then?
we've supported each other.
I can't imagine going through this without my friends here. And that's something that I wanted, you know, to convey really early on, is that there's a lot of camaraderie with all of the people who show up to try and keep people safe. And it could have been anyone. And it just happened to be people who were friends.
That's right. That's right.
We have this, you know, system of emergency contacts. In case anything happens, you can call my friend, you can call this friend. And we were all each other's emergency contacts, because we never imagined that we would ever be at the same place at the same time where something would happen. And that's how close we were. So it wasn't just a situation where it was, the odds that it was all of my close friends at a park. I mean, we prepare for this idea that we're going to interface with this high level of violence, because we experienced it just escalating and escalating. And you see this inevitability of serious harm. And so we get ballistic vests and we just expect it, you know? And you don't expect to be just standing at a park with your friends.
Yeah, we've been in a lot of high conflict situations. And I will say that this shooting that happened to us, I didn't expect it. And I didn't, because I wasn't really experiencing some of the things that the other women that were with us that night were experiencing, because I showed up later. But this was kind of like, as things were winding down, this is a march that's really well known. I really just wasn't expecting it to happen that night. There's been plenty of other times that we've had guns pointed at us. Plenty of other times where I was like, we're actually really lucky that we didn't get shot that time, because this person was extremely angry. And this, I just wasn't expecting it to be this time.
I'm not expecting it to be there, especially, I mean, I have this, I've been, you know, telling my therapist for so long, somebody's going to get shot and it's going to be at an intersection, because that's where you interface with angry people. I just always thought that it would be at an intersection when we were defending something, where we could say we were protecting a crowd. We were protecting people who were marching in the street using their voice. And it wasn't.
Fact that the shooter actively sought a group of people who were isolated from the larger crowd, and attacked them, would you say immediately?
Well, go ahead, Jay.
Ben Smith approached me about a half hour before the shooting to have a conversation with me about, he asked what was going on. I told him there was planning to be a march. He asked what time it was leaving. I told him, he looked at his watch and he came back at that time that I said that the march was planning on leaving, and came directly at me and Hank, who were at my car. I believe that he knew where the crowd was, and he was watching us, and he came back to us.
Yeah, we've heard from a couple people, and I think Hank can substantiate this, that he came up to, you know, Doug at 7:30, and I walked by as that interaction was happening, and I remember him lifting up his hand, looking at his watch, and saying, it's 7:30, you're leaving at 8? Okay, it's 7:30. And from what we've heard, he was either standing there on that corner or pacing up and down 55th Avenue, just watching us for 30 minutes. And it's made me think a lot since then. Was he just sitting there kind of amping himself up, knowing that the crowd would be coming eventually around that corner and slowly watching us one by one peel off and get into our vehicles? Did he have this moment where he thought, this is my last opportunity to get to the smallest group of people and hurt them? Smallest person in the smallest group. Did he see our friend walk away? Did he see me start to cross the street to my vehicle? And that's why he approached, because he saw that Deg was about to get into her car. And after that, his only confrontation opportunity would be with a crowd and with armed protection. He was a coward.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you all for sharing your experience. I think it's important for people to understand more details about what happened and how it frankly fits into a broader context of things that are happening in our society. Kat, Deja, Ali, Deg, and Hank, thank you for coming on Culture in Motion. Going forward, how can people support you?
The support that means a lot to me coming from other people is hearing them amplify messages that support survivors of violence and who place blame where it's due. And in this case, that blame is squarely on alt-right extremism, and seeing people acknowledge what they can do to start limiting these on-ramps that people have to that degree of violent extremism, that means support to me. Seeing somebody really, really acknowledge what happened to us, it's not because he had access to guns, it's not because he was mentally ill, it's because he had access to alt-right extremist resources and propagandists. And if we're going to get to any point where people can possibly avoid reaching that level of danger, we have to find ways to stop that. Mm. Acknowledgement feels like support.
Yeah, I hope that this experience humanizes us, you know, and people have made comments to me like, oh, you're like a normal person, like being surprised. Like, yeah, we're just normal people. We just didn't want people to get squished in the street. And I guess, you know, that's more of a radical notion than I thought it was. you know, and I don't know. I guess I would ask people to rethink their judgment of violent protesters, you know, and keep our humanity in mind. And, you know, like Deja said, to sort of limit some of those on-ramps, you know, that we're violent and, you know, we're burning the city down and we just don't want people to get killed in the street. Like, that's why we were there. We're just there to protect people.
I think for me, the best way that people can support is to show up. Like, if you have opinions about things going on, why don't you investigate it for yourself? And show up to one of these marches and see what they're really like and see what it's like to be targeted by complete strangers for like this complete outrage. Like, it doesn't feel good, but also to experience like the joy of being in a big crowd of people who all are aligned in the same ideals of like, we want to uplift and protect people who are vulnerable within our communities. And to just experience the pure joy of being in that kind of environment. Like, I would love to share that with more people. And I think that more folks would get involved if they were able to experience that.
And the solidarity of it too.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a really impactful part of this that brought a lot of people just into activism, you know, during that 2020 uprising in general, was experiencing the level of unity and, connection that you have that you really don't experience in a lot of other places. And I look at a lot of people who are have anger because they feel alone, or hateful because they feel isolated, and I look at this incredible community and the solidarity that I think we all acknowledge is, it's precious. There's nothing like it. I can't compare it to anything else, and I wish that everybody had the opportunity to experience that.
Yeah, June talked a lot about these people that are maligned and for wearing black block and being, you know, leftist or Antifa or whatever, and they're just the best. They were the best people that she'd ever known, and she just was always like so amazed and loved them all so much. Like, she'd never found a community like that before, and it was very precious to her. And also what they were doing, that was so important. But just the solidarity of these people.
Two things come to mind in closing, and one is that there's an ongoing question that those of us who participate in work, in solidarity, coalition work, movement work, are often asking ourselves, what is it that would push one to put themselves at risk for the safety of others? And that's a very important question, you know? And, you know, I'm left at wondering, how do we continue the work? You know, how do we go forward after taking losses? I want to thank you all for participating in the conversation. I'm hoping to carry it on further. I think this is an important part of a story, and this is an important story in and of itself. So thank you all for making time to be on Culture Emotion, and y'all have a good day.
KBOO Portland.
Thank you.
Calling all denizens of Earth. Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. for KBOO's Earth Day Takeover. It's a whole day of radio programming devoted to climate action and environmental justice. Join us and prepare for nature sounds, music, and activist interviews focused on our shared climate future. That's KBOO's Earth Day Takeover on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and online at kboo.fm/earthday.
Tune in to KBOO Saturday, April 22nd at 7 p.m. for the rebroadcast of Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to Billie Holiday. The 16th annual Billie Holiday Tribute brings together musicians of many genres to pay tribute to influential jazz singer and songwriter